talking about Meridian Hill Malcolm X Park this month, we want to give a shout out to the Friends of Meridian Hill organization, which is a volunteer group that is part of the larger Washington Parks and People. You can volunteer with them if you want to do it in person, show up to one of their community days to clean the park, but you can also volunteer from home with data entry and content writing for their website, or you can just donate. And you can do all of this at washingtonparks.net.
Welcome back to Tour Guide Tell All. This is one of your hosts, Dan King, and this week we're going to talk about one of my favorite places in Washington, D.C., and possibly one of the more beautiful places as well, and that is Meridian Hill Park, sometimes known as Malcolm X Park, especially to D.C. locals. Now, first of all, where is this park? Well, if you look at a map of Washington, D.C., and look directly at the White House, and then move north exactly about 1.5 miles, that is Meridian Hill. And it takes its name from the fact that Thomas Jefferson, never wanting to be outdone by the Europeans, was very enamored with the idea of creating a new American prime meridian. And one of the places he thought that should go through was the White House. So in 1804, when he is president, he is actually going to order the surveying of such a line. Today, just sort of close to the Washington Monument, is a place or thing called Jefferson's Pier. And that marked sort of one survey stone of where this line was. And then about 1.5 miles north of the White House, just outside of what at the time was called Peters Hill, named for Robert Peters, a wealthy Georgetown merchant, and another survey stone was placed there, just sort of on the hilltop, with a beautiful view of Washington, D.C. and the Potomac. This was sometimes called the White House Meridian, or actually more commonly called the 16th Street Meridian, as it basically follows 16th Street directly north of the White House. Even though this is Jefferson's idea, and even though he very much wants to have an American prime meridian, there's no real follow-up to this. No mapmakers ever use this as the zero line of longitude, and it just sort of becomes this weird artifact of Washington, D.C., but one of those artifacts will be the naming of this hill. Now, after the War of 1812, a man by the name of Commodore David Porter will buy the property, about 116 acres surrounding that whole area, from Robert Peters, and he will name both the land and the large mansion he builds on it Meridian Hill. So that's where it gets its formal name. Now, sort of looking at the timeline, how does this thing get to be such a beautiful park that it is today? Well, in 1821, Columbia College is chartered by Congress. Today, we better know Columbia College as George Washington University. And part of the reason for that is that this was really Washington's dream. This was his idea. He wanted the nation's capital to have a grand university. And so he actually leaves money for this endeavor in the form of shares in his company, the Potomac Company. And unfortunately, that company has some problems. So there's not much funds that he actually ends up leaving. So it's going to take another 20 years for individuals to get involved, for Congress to get involved. And then, as I said, finally in 1821, Columbia College is chartered. They purchase land very close by or sort of surrounding Porter's mansion there. And this is sort of the way the area is until about the Civil War. Now, with the beginning of the Civil War, the expanse of land and all the buildings that were then a part of Columbia College are quickly converted to Union Hospital use, and a military encampment pops up around it called Camp Cameron. One of D.C.'s most famous residents during this time, Walt Whitman, will be one of many volunteers to come and work at this sort of hospital campground. Now, in the years immediately after the Civil War, and specifically 1873, Columbia College will, of course, be renamed George Washington University, and the campus is actually going to move downtown to an area we now call Foggy Bottom. It's during this time in the late 1800s that the infamous D.C. boss political boss Alexander Shepard, who was charged by Congress with beautifying the city and trying to make what had been sort of this ragtag capital during the Civil War into an actual capital to compete with the grand European capitals as well. So Boss Shepard actually looks at the area around Meridian Hill and thinks it would be a wonderful place as sort of a cultural focal point for the city. Unfortunately, he doesn't really follow through with many of these plans, but the idea, the spark of that idea is there. And in 1889, when a very important woman to this endeavor, one Mary Foote Henderson, moves to Washington, D.C., she sort of takes up that mantle. And before I get into too much about her plans for this area, I'm going to let Candon explain a little bit about this remarkable woman.
Let me talk about Mary Foote Henderson for a bit on a personal level, because she was a fascinating lady. So her mother campaigned for women's rights and was on the editorial board for the first women's rights convention at Seneca Falls. She was also a scientist. She basically discovered climate change in the 1850s, noting that the changes in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affects its temperature, which is what we call the greenhouse gas effect. And she did this 3 years before the man who we often give the credit to. But, you know, that was back to Mary. So that was Mary's mom, an incredible working mom role model to have growing up. Her father was a patent lawyer. He was also a signer at the Seneca Falls Convention. And her uncle was a senator who invited her down to Washington, D.C. And here she meets Senator John B. Henderson from Missouri. Now, his name isn't often recognized, but he was one of the ones who co-authored the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. Keep in mind that at the time, Missouri was a slave state. So Mary Foote and John B. Henderson are married. Senator Henderson is not reelected for a number of reasons. He also voted for the acquittal in Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial. They move to St. Louis and accidentally become very wealthy. He buys up lots of bonds at the end of the war for very cheap, and then he is paid face value for them. So they move back to Washington, D.C., and they buy a whole bunch of land in the area. They built this incredible mansion on the corner of 16th and what is now Florida Avenue. It was originally called Boundary Road because it was the boundary between Washington City and Washington County. So this area was still kind of semi-rural in the late 1800s. So Boundary Castle, as it was called, looked very much like a castle. Imagine this brown stone, there's turrets, and the walls have like these up and down blocks. They're called crenellated battlements, but I'm not sure anyone would know what that means. But seriously, just ask a six-year-old to draw a castle, and that is what Boundary Castle looked like. Most of it's gone now, but the original wall, it still stands on 16th Street with its crenellated battlements. So Mary got involved in her neighborhood at the height of the City Beautiful movement that influenced her involvement in creating the park, but she was also very into temperance movement. Her lavish dinner parties were a very inclusive invitation, but they were strictly alcohol-free. Now, her husband did not adhere to this. He had a very large cellar full of very fine wine, and after his death, she and her butler, who was also part of the temperance society, they brought all the wine upstairs to the front yard and smashed them on the ground. Newspapers reported that the gutters filled with wine and locals were coming out with spoons and tin cans to save what they could. After she died, the castle was bought. It was opened as a tennis and swimming club, and the ballroom was turned into a bar, which Mary would not have approved of. For all of her strengths as a promoter of good health, well, as she saw it at least, by not drinking, and vegetarianism, and for women's rights, she very much dismissed the local Black American population. She wanted a great Italian Renaissance park and had grand buildings for embassies built along 16th Street. But the problem was is that there were already people living there. A working-class Black community had resided there since the Civil War. So she claimed it as, quote, our hill, and she called the single-story frame houses shacks. She dismissed that most of them were owned by the residents. They were all forced to leave, and their homes were torn down. So if you go to Meridian Hill Malcolm X Park today, there's really no evidence that this was a residential neighborhood. ever.
I really just love that story of the broken wine bottles and everyone sort of clamoring to get their share out of the gutter. So temperance, an interesting time. But as you can see, Mary Henderson, a very fascinating woman. And as Camden mentioned, she is definitely part of the City Beautiful movement. Now, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's sort of an interesting architectural slash progressive social movement. And the idea was that cities, which were becoming denser and denser, especially as the Industrial Revolution progressed, that cities were sort of hellholes. And that this was having an effect on the moral and social character of the people who lived inside these cities. So part of the idea of the City Beautiful movement is if you create beautiful monuments, beautiful parks, that this would lead to a moral resurgence above the people and would add to their civic virtue, that they would care about the places that they lived in and have some civic pride for these types of cities. So some of the main cities that undertake the City Beautiful movement, Chicago, Cleveland is a big one, and also Washington, D.C. So it's sort of an interesting idea that this would engender some sort of harmonious social order. And that is also going to be a response to these rapidly declining health conditions in many of these urban centers. So she is very much a part of the City Beautiful movement. She has a lot of wealth. She has a lot of status. She has a lot of connections. And she uses all of these things to tell Congress, members of Congress, that the area of Meridian Hill really needs to be a cultural focal point for the city. And that's how she sort of gets these shanties, as she might call them, removed from the area and torn down. She has a lot of beautiful embassies built up. So that was her vision for the neighborhood, tearing down this African-American working class neighborhood and sort of building these elaborate, huge embassies, which still line 16th Street around Meridian Hill. Now, she does lobby unsuccessfully. She doesn't have all the power and clout. She actually really wanted two different ideas for Meridian Hill. One of them is fascinating, and we might do an episode on an Imagine DC or a What If DC. But one of the plans was to remove the White House, to actually build a grand presidential palace that would be on Meridian Hill. And especially at the time, the White House was old. You can hear stories going back even to Lincoln and even further than that about how dilapidated and how small and how confining the White House is. Instead of moving it, though, they do end up building the additions that we know today as the East Wing and the West Wing. So this idea for a grand presidential palace on top of Meridian Hill doesn't pan out. Her next big idea is the Lincoln Memorial. So that was swirling around Congress. They knew they wanted to build this grand and majestic memorial someplace in Washington, D.C. And before the area where it is today was finally decided, one of the proposals was for the Lincoln Memorial to be placed on top of Meridian Hill. Now, even though she fails at these gestures, she still has a lot of influence with what was called the McMillan Commission. This was a Senate committee that was tasked with sort of improving and finishing L'Enfant's grand plan for Washington, D.C., and the McMillan Commission ends up taking in a lot of these ideas of the City Beautiful movement. So while the McMillan Commission's plan is never formally adopted by the city, by Congress, it still sort of serves as a comprehensive planning guide, even to this day, about what Washington, D.C. will turn into. It's sort of implemented in a piecemeal nature. It's not sort of all done at once. But at this time, they do agree that Meridian Hill should be some sort of grand urban park in 1910. And by 1913, the area surrounding Meridian Hill is one of the most elite and desirable in the entire city, and largely in anticipation of what Mary Foote Henderson had already done to bring embassies and these big, beautiful houses there. Also in anticipation of this grand, beautiful Meridian Hill park. From the time they break ground to begin construction of the park, it will take over 20 years to finally finish this, and Mary Foot Henderson is instrumental in keeping pressure on Congress to continue to supply the funds to finish it. Now, Meridian Hill Park, shockingly, is on the slope of a hill, and so some people almost say that it's two different parks sort of joined together by this theme of a grand European urban place. So the upper part is actually designed in sort of a formal Baroque French manner with what they call a tapis vert, which is a very French way of saying lawn. So it is a big open space, largely green grass, and becomes perfect for political rallies, for the community to come together, for picnics, for all sorts of things. But we'll get into a little bit more of that later. And then as it begins its slope down the hill, the bottom of the park is more in an Italian Renaissance style. And actually the central focal feature is a giant cascading waterfall. 13 different levels of this waterfall coming down the hill. And it really is beautiful. It's not something you would expect to see in the midst of Washington, D.C., and it is stunningly gorgeous. Now, all the walls, all the benches, the promenades, the fountain itself is actually made from a concrete aggregate, which is basically sort of concrete mixed with clean, smooth pebbles. And so the pebbles are rough and exposed on the surface of this concrete. This process was actually created by a Joseph Early, who was in the area. He had a studio in the area, and this is sometimes called the Early process. He was fascinated by sort of the polychrome nature of Byzantine architecture, and he sort of wanted to see if he could update that with this sort of new-ish material of concrete, and this is the process he comes up with. Now, to be totally honest, not one of my favorite features of this park. It looks great from afar, but I almost refer to it as an early form of brutalism with this sort of exposed concrete pebble there. But many people do enjoy it, do like it, and do like the effect it has. But it does mean that this takes an extensively long time to finish. The park is finally dedicated in 1936, so about 23 years there, and it immediately becomes hugely popular with residents of the neighborhood. The National Park Service would later state, the scope and ambition of Meridian Hill Park sets it apart. The idea of creating a Renaissance villa landscape in the middle of an American city to serve as a public park and cultural center has no true parallel. Now, the park will become very useful to local neighborhood residents, as I said, political rallies, coming together, using it for picnics and things like that. And especially in the 1960s, it does become a huge rally point for all sorts of political statements that the residents of Washington, D.C. wanted to make. So rallies for civil rights, rallies for the poor, rallies to eliminate hunger. Meridian Hill Park becomes the focal point of all these things. And this is where we get the name split. So you've heard both Candid and I refer to it, well, sort of historically I refer to it as Meridian Hill, but today I would say Meridian Hill / Malcolm X Park. And that's because at one of these rallies, a major rally in 1969, after the devastating effects of the riots of 1968 associated with the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., African-American activist Angela Davis, an amazing woman in her own right, she actually proposed a new name for the park. She wanted it to be called Malcolm X Park. Now, the problem with this is, as I just stated from that National Park Service statement, this is actually still National Park Service land. Even to this day, the city of Washington, D.C. does not technically own the property there. And so to fully change the name, to formally change the name, it would have to be an act of Congress. And for some reason, Congress has never been really keen on the idea of officially renaming it to be Malcolm X Park. So sometimes there'll be this divide among what people see on a map, which is Meridian Hill Park, and what locals have been calling it for now generations, and that is Malcolm Malcolm X Park. Now, for the next 20 years, especially in the 1970s and 1980s, the area around the park really starts to suffer. Some of this is left over from the riots that so devastate Washington, D.C. from 1968. It takes a long time for the city to bounce back from that. And by the 1990s, the park is in total disrepair. The National Park Service had sort of given up on it. They weren't maintaining the fountains, weren't maintaining the structures or features or anything like that. And it quickly becomes, because of the walls, because it's sort of a walled-off park, it becomes a great place for drug dealers, other sort of nefarious criminal activity. And one of the things I really love about the history of this park is that it's the residents, it's the locals who really get fed up with this situation. And they come together and they form what we talked about at the beginning of this episode, the Friends of Meridian Hill Park, which is this organizing committee to do all sorts of things to improve this park. They do tree plantings. So they sort of take down the rotted trees and trees that had collapsed. They plant new ones in their place. They lobby the National Park Service to fix up the infrastructure. And one of my most favorite parts of the history of the Friends of Meridian Hill Park is what they called the Smile Campaign. They organized volunteer patrols, especially at evening time when many residents, quite frankly, were afraid to go into the park after dark. And they organized this Smile Campaign, which is so brilliant. They had teams of 3 to 5 citizens who would just sort of walk around the park. And when they encountered someone who may or may not have been involved in some nefarious criminal activity, they just smiled at them. Big, beaming, beautiful smiles. They didn't accuse them of anything. They didn't try to force them out. They just sort of smiled at them and talked to them. And shockingly, people who are engaged in criminal activities feel really put off by a bunch of people coming over to them and smiling at them. And so almost through sheer force of will and smiles, the residents basically evict the drug dealers and other criminal elements that had taken over the park. It just wasn't a good place for them with all these sort of normal average citizens walking around smiling and beaming brightly at them. And that pretty much brings us to where we are today with Meridian Hill / Malcolm X Park. It's a really beautiful asset for the city and especially for the residents of the area, Columbia Heights, the U Street area. Really a wonderful amenity. One of my favorite activities when I used to live a little bit closer was going to the weekly drum circle. Yes, every Sunday there is a drum circle that meets on the upper part of the park in that big lawn, beautiful lawn. And dancers and professional drummers will participate in this weekly drum circle, usually from about 3 in the afternoon onward. And it really is a very cool thing to witness and see. So one of those fun little insider tips, if you do end up coming to Washington, D.C., one of those fun things you can see is this Sunday afternoon drum circle. Now, later on, when we do a few more of these mini episodes, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into some of the beautiful statues that are in this gorgeous park. But for now, I'm going to wrap things up here. This has been another wonderful episode, a little mini episode for you of Tour Guide Tell All. And we hope you'll join us next time as we dig deeper into fun facts of history and Washington, D.C.
Next week on Tour Guide Tell All, we're going to tell you more about Betsy Ross. You might think you know who she is and what she did, but do you really? Tour Guide Tell All is brought to you by the guides of Free Tours by Foot Washington, D.C. You can support us by becoming a patron on our Patreon page, Tour Guide Tell All. We also have an email account, tourguidetellall@gmail.com. If you guys have any questions or comments or ideas for future episodes, please let us know. The best way to support us and help us out is to give us 5-star reviews, share the podcast with friends and family and strangers so they can listen to us chat about American history.